everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2026, and you're listening to episode 512, which is a conversation about the Odyssey, the epic poem by Homer. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Matthew Deem, who has a PhD in English with a concentration in medieval literature from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He also teaches Latin at Covenant Day School in Matthews, North Carolina. His work has appeared in Arthuriana and under a pseudonym in Arion. Matt has written an online feature article for our literary apologetics column in the Christian Research Journal. His article is called "The Gods and Monsters of Homer's Odyssey, a Christian Framework." And you can read the article for free online at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Matt, it's great to have you on the podcast for the first time.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Melanie.
Well, as I noted, Matt has written an article for us on Homer's Odyssey, and it's really become quite the big hit because of the Christopher Nolan film that is recently out. And so if you're a listener and you've missed our other episode of a review of Christopher Nolan's film, The Odyssey, you might want to go back and listen to that, as well as read the article that we have on our website about the film. But today we want to talk about the actual work by Homer, The Odyssey. And first of all, before we get into the details about it, I want to ask you in particular, what, as a scholar, as a teacher, what is the something that's interesting to you? What do you like about Homer's Odyssey in general? Because I think the idea of this ancient work could be intimidating to a lot of people. Maybe they haven't read some books in a long time, especially some of the classic works of Western literature. Maybe they have not ever even kind of dabbled in that, attempted to read that. So what interests you about this work?
Well, I actually just enjoy it. I discovered several years ago that my Greek had actually put me up to the task of reading the Homeric epics in the original. And when you can actually sit down and just go through it, it flows and rolls very nicely. The rhythm of Homer's dactylic hexameter, Andromoyen nepomusapolutropon hos malapola plache petro yesiaron toliethrona persen polon anthropon irenaste akaino on egno, maybe? Anyway, I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating there for effect, but it really is just very, very powerful and enjoyable when you actually get what it's saying. The Odyssey, especially compared with the Iliad, it's better. I shouldn't say better known. It's better liked in general for good reason, because a lot of interesting stuff happens in it. You've got monsters and battles and deception and backstabbing and all that jazz. And it really is just something that people have been able to get a lot out of for the last, what should I say now, almost 3,000 years, 2,700, let's say. I mean, whether that's, well, something like the latest Odyssey movie that came out this summer. I mean, people like Emily Wilson criticized it for essentially turning Homer into an action movie, but it says a lot that Homer could be turned into something like an action movie. Or long, long before that, you have things like some of the earliest Greek tragedies are derived from Homeric material because it is just inherently dramatic, works out very well on stage, either seriously or there's actually a play called The Cyclops by Euripides, which is the only surviving ancient satyr play, which takes the Cyclops incident from the Odyssey and turns it into what we would call a farce, makes a fool out of both Odysseus and the Cyclops, essentially, or I guess has Odysseus making a fool out of the Cyclops, something like that. But there's just so much and such varied material, and it's all very intense. Even in passages that can come across as a little dull, if you can appreciate the verse form of it, again, comes at you very heavily. Again, especially if you can read in the original where it's dun 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 dun. So.
Well, before I ask you more questions about it, some of our listeners might not even be familiar. Like I said to them, we did a review of the film, but for some people that are not familiar with this work, as you note, that's almost 3,000 years old, can you give us just kind of an overview of the story? What is the Odyssey about?
Right. So both of the Homeric epics, the epic poems attributed to this cryptic unknown figure that we traditionally call Homer, are stories related to the, are part of the sequence of myths related to the Trojan War. All right. So background, hard to say where to start with this, but the long and short of it is, for reasons related to the figure of Helen of Troy, a Greek princess who is abducted or possibly seduced and taken to Troy, a coalition of Greek city-states invade Troy on the coast of what's now Turkey, take 10 years besieging it until finally they take it, having lost most of their best men. Then the Odyssey is specifically about the homecoming of one of the surviving Greek heroes, the king of Ithaca, named Odysseus, or in Latin, Ulysses, a name that you'll often hear in older English sources especially. For instance, Ulysses S. Grant is called that in reference to this character. He takes another 10 years to get home after the war because for a variety of reasons, he has upset various gods, most notably the sea god Poseidon, known in Latin as Neptune. And first, he gets blown all over the Mediterranean Sea, blah, blah, blah. And then finally, all of his followers are killed in various storms and shipwrecks, etc. And he himself is left stranded on the island of Ogygia with a minor sea goddess named Calypso, who holds him captive for another couple of years. And that's actually the point where the poem begins, because ancient epics like the Odyssey always open in medias res, is jumping into the middle of things. And the Odyssey actually opens with Odysseus' son Telemachus back home on Ithaca, who was a baby when Odysseus left, now in his early 20s. And he is convinced that his father is still alive and essentially is prompted by the gods to go out and look for news of Odysseus. Then we shift to Odysseus himself on Calypso's island, where the same goddess, Athena, who had prompted Telemachus to go look for Odysseus, manages to get Odysseus finally away from Calypso. But then he washes up on the island of Scheria with people called the Phaeacians. And that's where he actually tells the story that we're now hearing for the first time of how he ended up with Calypso, with all the famous incidents of his encounters with monsters like the Cyclops Polyphemus, or sailing by the Sirens, or having to make the choice between going by the six-headed monster Scylla and the whirlpool Charybdis. And then finally, after telling his story, the people whose island he's washed up on are able to give him a ship back home. And finally, he's able to get there, no issues. In fact, so easily that they put him on shore while he's still asleep. And at first, he doesn't realize where he is. And then the second half of the poem, because all of that was only books 1 to 12 out of 24, the whole second half of the poem is about his efforts to essentially find out how things have been in his absence and restore himself as king, because in the years he's been gone, Everybody except, again, his son Telemachus and his wife Penelope have assumed that he's dead, and there is a large group of unruly and obnoxious suitors who are trying to convince Penelope to marry one of them again, believing that her husband is dead. Then, of course, he finally reveals himself that, in fact, he is still alive, and he massacres all of the suitors. And that's more or less the end of the poem.
Well, this is really interesting. I think that right now we are having such a revival in interest in the Odyssey, and very much, just like you said, all these different adventures of Odysseus, these different, you know, ancient gods and creatures and things like that. So why do you think that there is some more modern interest? I mean, maybe some people might not know all the different ways in which it's found its incarnations in the last, I don't know, 25, 30 years, even in films, other films, not just Nolan's Odyssey.
Yeah, I tend to think of this as a revival of interest in the Odyssey, but there's a real sense in which interest in it just never went away. You really can find things just all throughout history that have in different ways adapted the Odyssey. I mean, my favorite example, just because it's completely random, is Cream, the band best known for Sunshine of Your Love, also has a song clearly derived from the Odyssey called Tales of Brave Ulysses. Very interesting hearing Homeric themes sung to psychedelic tunes. Anyway, a lot of it's just stuff that comes in through osmosis, cultural osmosis, you know. People know what the Cyclops is, even if they don't know anything about Homer. People know what a siren song means. And it's powerful stuff just because it's very primal. I mean, you could think of it as primitive, belonging to an age of fable, of, you know, benighted, simple thinking. But at the same time, that primitiveness can be a strength because it kind of strips away any particular cultural trappings, but it strips away a lot of them, because what we have with the wanderings of Odysseus, especially where he has encounters with monsters and the like of that, is essentially man against nature or man against the world. It isn't really tied to the specific Greek culture, even if that shapes some of the ideas about the natural world. In large part, that just means it's unaccommodated man, as Shakespeare says. We don't have anything that is, you know, related in any deep way to technology in dealing with nature. So there's a kind of universality to it, is what I'm getting at. Obviously, it's not completely universal, but it emphasizes a lot of things that are kind of central to any experience of the world that is taken away from anything that makes you safe in civilization, society, technology, etc. And so it can be repurposed in different ways because it's not so clearly tied to any particular historical moment or cultural moment. Because, I mean, it should be emphasized, the Homeric epics were written, or I guess I should say composed, because they were originally apparently circulated orally, a very long time after any historical period that they might represent. So it's already kind of filtered through this universalizing mythological tendency. And that, again, it has the advantage of stripping away a lot of cultural and historical particulars in order to emphasize this is what man against the world looks like. And that necessarily has a very broad appeal, even in the 21st century.
If you have online habits like I do, every time the pop-up comes or someone asks for ratings and reviews, I just think to myself, I'll do it later, and I never get around to it. But I really want to, because I appreciate the food that I ate, the place that I stayed, or the podcast that I listened to, or the video that I watched. So I would like to ask you to partner with us by rating and reviewing our podcast, specifically on Apple Podcasts, as well as on Spotify. Those are the two main venues in which our work can get seen. And the more people that hear about this podcast and listen to it, the more people will help us to grow the reach of this podcast. And we are here to help Christians think Christianly and understand what they believe and why they believe it. And so we want to equip Christians worldwide with this and with our podcast. So we are grateful for you partnering with us in that way. Also, we want you to help us to grow our other podcast, which is Christian Research Journal Reads. If you haven't even given it a try, I suggest that you do, because it's the actual audio articles that you hear us talking about every week. I interview the authors about their articles, but you can listen to those articles, the full text of those articles on that podcast. And it's just an easier way if you don't have time to sit down on your device or your computer to read the article, that you can listen to it while you're doing some chores or working out or taking a drive in your car. So thank you so much for partnering with us. We are really grateful for that, and discover so much content on this podcast. As a matter of fact, we are over 500 episodes. This one is 512. We've been going for 10 years, and that's a lot of content. And our content isn't dated, because even the movies that we talk about or the TV shows that we do, series that you can stream, live on because of streaming. That didn't used to be true back in the day, but now because we have streaming services, all these films, TV shows, and of course we can get audiobooks and ebooks and everything else that we talk about, that you can still get an idea of what some of this content is. And as a matter of fact, a lot of these shows and movies, even though they might have come out a while back, they are still some of the most watched things or streamed things online still after many years. So we would like you to continue to discover our content, pass it along. We're going towards 300 episodes on Christian Research Journal Reads, and we are just so grateful again for your partnership. Well, I hope you've been enjoying all the coverage we've done on the Odyssey. If you've missed our in-depth discussion about the Christopher Nolan film with our film reviewer, Cole Burgett, please go back a few episodes to listen to that podcast and then listen to the audio article of that podcast. And hope you're enjoying this conversation about the actual text of the epic poem by Homer. So now back to my conversation with Matt Dean.
So before the break, you were talking a little bit about recognizable, you know, characters, maybe I'd say, in this epic poem. And some of those are monsters that everybody is familiar with. And you mentioned the Cyclops. I think most people culturally know that a Cyclops is a giant with one eye. You also mentioned the Sirens, and you talked about the Siren song. So that makes its way into a lot of, you know, contemporary pop culture, you know, views of, like, for example, mermaids or something like that. They have that. And so what about this idea of monsters in this poem? Can you give some more specific examples of how these particular monsters in the Odyssey can, you know, we can interpret those as real world dangers? Because it seems like they're prominent in the poem. There's a theme of having monsters in it. So talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So actually, before I start on that, I just want to point out one interesting piece of trivia. We all know that the Cyclops has one eye, but it's interesting that in the Odyssey itself, there is no definitive hint that Homer actually understood a Cyclops that way. It's interesting because there are reference with Cyclops. There's always, sorry, whenever it talks about eyes, the word eye occurs in the singular, but talk about eyebrows and eyelids are always in the plural, which actually has led some to think that the idea of the Cyclops is only having one eye as a later development. And B has led to the very interesting pictorial tradition that you occasionally see, that reconciles these two things, where the Cyclops has one eye, as we usually think of, in the center of the forehead, and then two empty eye sockets in the normal places. Very interesting, very odd. I really don't like the pictures that draw that way. They just look really disgusting to me. Anyway, to get to the actual question with that tangent aside, I actually want to start by talking a little bit more about the Sirens, because that's a well-known example, and is also one that's really easy to draw some kind of more abstract message out of. Okay, so just to recap what's going on with the Sirens. This is, I believe, book 12 of the Odyssey. The Sirens are creatures living on the coast of this one island who sing a song that is so enchanting that anyone who hears it will necessarily be drawn to it, jump into the sea, and drown. Or, you know, the ship will wash up on the rocks and they'll drown. So what Odysseus does to be able to pass by that coast safely is he has all of his men stuff their ears with wax so that they cannot hear and be affected by the song. But he himself wants to hear the music. So he comes up with a way to do that without dying by having himself tied to the mast of his ship so that he literally can't jump into the water and drown. And what's really interesting about that is it's so easy to turn that into a kind of psychological, almost allegory. The Sirens become essentially an embodiment of a destructive but pleasant thing. And what Odysseus is trying to do is get the pleasure without getting the destruction. So it's a kind of common, you know, it's a way of commending his endless cunning, which is his defining feature. It shows him, it presents him with a moral dilemma. On the one hand, there is this which is pleasant. On the other hand, this can also lead to my destruction. And he comes up with a way of splitting the difference between the two. I mean, we could start coming up with real world examples of that kind of moral dilemma, but I won't waste time by trying to come up with something out of, say, my own life. So that's an easy example. Or something like the Lotus Eaters in, I want to say it's book 9. So here, early on in his wanderings, when he still has most of his followers, Odysseus and his ships come across an island where there is a tribe of people who eat nothing but a flower called lotus that may or may not be the same as the real world flower called lotus. And in this mythological world, eating lotus causes them to forget all their troubles. And what happens to those of Odysseus' men to whom the lotus eaters offer some of the lotus is they don't want to go home anymore. They have forgotten Ithaca and their entire previous lives, and they just stay on the island with the lotus eaters and essentially just become part of this tribe. And so first of all, we can actually see that as a sort of representation of fears about traveling to unfamiliar places and then being, you know, seduced by their ways, so to speak, and going native, which is a classic fear of explorers and colonialists. Won't get into that in more detail, except to say what I've already said. But in a kind of more abstract way, this is a dilemma that we can, you know, see in moral terms as a life of ease and following the duties of, you know, living the life that you've been appointed to, so to speak. Because keep in mind, not going home, that means that they kind of just abandon their families and all of their social obligations back home in favor of essentially doing drugs for all time. And so, I mean, that's something that, I mean, even my offhand flippant reference to doing drugs, the lotus can be kind of seen as representative of temptation to just give in to something like drowning all your sorrows and concerns with endless drinking, regardless of any consequences of that for, you know, your family and society around you. Obviously, that's just one kind of reductive reading of that, but I mean that to say, this is an example of how we can see real world parallels in these mythic images of, you know, I've used the term monster, but, you know, lotus eaters are people, but they're a fantastic or really exotic people that have an otherworldly quality to them.
So I would like you to elaborate more about, in your article, you talk about the importance of the sea to the monsters in the Odyssey, as well as maybe some biblical examples of monsters. And for our listeners who aren't that familiar with this poem, I mean, it's taking him, how long does it take him? A decade to get back?
More That's than right, that? 10 years.
Yes, it takes him a decade to get back to his home in Ithaca. And it's funny, I'm sure by modern terms, you know, if he made that same journey, it would not take 10 years. But he is on the sea. He goes to he and his crew find different islands, different places where some of these monsters are. So his journey is on the sea. So talk a little bit more about that. Why is that particularly important, the sea?
Yes. So the sea is almost always an emblem of chaos and uncertainty. I mean, you have to just think about what the sea is like. It's constantly fluctuating. Our word fluctuate actually comes from a Latin word for wave, because change is very well represented by just thinking about what the surface of the sea looks like, or even what the seashores look like with tides and storms and things like that. And when you are on the sea, you are entirely at the mercy of forces that you cannot control. The waves and winds just throw boats around as they will. I mean, that's why it's such a big deal in the Gospels that Jesus calms a storm and his disciples turn to each other and say, "Who is he that even the winds and the waves obey him?" Because regardless of how much you advance in sailing technology, you cannot change the weather. And the quality of a sea journey is almost entirely dependent on, you know, how the winds and the waves are.
Right. I mean, you can't change the nature of the waves, no matter how much technology we have on the open ocean.
Yeah. And so coastlines, too, are a problem in certainly at least ships in Homer's day and in the mythological past represented in the Iliad and the Odyssey. Sometimes there are rocks you can't see. Sometimes you can't even see the island itself. That's why they invented lighthouses. I mean, even again, to go back to the sirens, it's possible that, you know, I don't know whether this has been actually seriously explored by scholars, but it's possible that this originated as a kind of mythic distortion of real life coastlines that looked safe to land at, but actually had hidden rocks that destroyed every ship that got close. But collectively, this just results in the sea as the ultimate expression of life being controlled by forces that we ourselves do not control. You see that just continually throughout all the history of literature. I mean, you see it in scripture. Think of the book of Jonah, for instance, where it is at the point where he sails that Jonah is brought to his lowest point. And I mean, he talks from the belly of the fish as if he were talking from the grave, literally refers to himself as speaking from the belly of Sheol. But it's not insignificant. My larger point is that Jonah gets his humbling and his reminder that he's not in control when he's taking a sea voyage, because that really is the point where he's attempting to make things go his way, but he literally cannot. And again, that continues for a very long time in literary tradition. Think of something like The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, where a long section of the poem involves the title character alone, alone, all alone, alone on the wide, wide sea. When the wind gives way, the ship just stops. There's nothing anybody can do about it. And, you know, 200 men die of thirst just sitting there. Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. Again, there's a definite attempt to control nature on their part, because they're actually going on an exploratory voyage by the looks of it, but they run afoul of the most basic facts of what the sea is like. Or think of Moby Dick. The whale essentially becomes an image of everything that threatens to destroy humanity. Captain Ahab is obsessed with trying to get control of it, i.e. by destroying the whale, but he can't. Nature always has its way, or I should say, God always trumps man, because God controls the sea.
Something that you talk about in your article is that you don't want the readers to think about these gods and monsters that are in the Odyssey as allegorical. And so how is that different from what you cite from C.S. Lewis about translating myth into abstractions? He's known for, you know, his children's works being allegorical.
The key problem here is the fact that the words symbolism, allegory, and there was a third one that just slipped out of my head, doesn't matter, can be defined in a bunch of different ways that overlap in different ways. Now, usually the simplest of them is allegory, and the issue with taking gods or monstrous figures from myth as allegorical is that allegory is just a one-to-one, simple, straightforward likeness or comparison. So, you know, the classic literary allegory, at least for us who speak English, is The Pilgrim's Progress. The main character is called Christian because he represents the ordinary Christian. There are characters with names like Pliable, who represents the person who is excessively pliable, who is too easily persuaded to do or stop doing something. Or you've got Mr. Worldly Wise Man. He's the man who is worldly wise. He represents worldly wisdom. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's one-to-one. With mythological imagery like what we have with the gods and monsters of the Odyssey, to try to reduce this to a simple, this represents this and nothing else, and that is how it is, would be taking way too much out of it. That is, they would be simplifying what its significance is to an unhelpful degree. So, I mean, to go back to an instance I've already given, I've suggested that the lotus eaters, or the temptation represented by eating the lotus flowers, like is something like alcoholism. But it isn't an allegory for excessive drinking or anything like that, because allegory would imply that that's all it is. Whereas it can be interpreted as any number of different things. Again, I actually mentioned another possibility. It looks like fears about going to distant places and being, you know, seduced by their ways, going native, whatever exactly the expression I used was. So there are already two very different interpretations right there. And already, I mean, pretty much anybody who is familiar with the poem is going to see my suggestions of those interpretations as overly reductive. And I would agree that they are overly reductive because they're just different manifestations of something that's deeper and more multifaceted. Or take an instance like the character of Athena, the goddess Athena. So she represents wisdom. She represents courage in battle. She represents, well, she represents for Odysseus, divine providence. Control over his fate by divine power. She's all sorts of different things at once, or rather can be all sorts of different things in different moments. That, you know, if she were just an allegorical figure called wisdom, she would be completely one note. There would be one way more or less of understanding any of her actions at any given point. But myth, as opposed to simple allegory, although myth and allegory can overlap, allows for all kinds of different things going on and allows for different interpretations often at the same time. So, for instance, it is possible to take a positive or negative view of different things that Odysseus does. We can understand them as representing the power of, say, brain over brawn, but we can interpret that in different ways. So, for instance, some readers have seen his blinding of the Cyclops Polyphemus as essentially an act of invasive brutality. Well, okay, that's a plausible reading, but even those readers who have taken it as what I just said about representing invasive brutality would definitely be taking it too far to say that it's, I don't know, an allegory for colonialism or invasion by hostile foreign forces or something like that, because there's more going on with it than that, even if that interpretation is right in saying, yeah, that's one element of what's going on there. The Cyclops incident also represents, as I said, brain over brawn, represents the potential hazards of excessive boasting, because immediately after he leaves the cave, or rather immediately after he sets sail after leaving the cave, Odysseus shouts back his own name, his real name, instead of the no one Utis trick. And that essentially is what allows the blinded Polyphemus to know where to throw a rock to hit Odysseus' ships. Whereas if Odysseus had held his tongue, Polyphemus, no longer having an eye, would have had no way of knowing where to aim his rock. So I hope that's giving a good example of, or all of that's giving a good idea of, essentially it's just more multifaceted than just, than if it's allegorical, or even if it's symbols for which you can give definite single names.
So then what exactly counts as a monster in the way that you're using the term? And for example, you talk about in your article, Charybdis. Now, I will say that in the Odyssey, I think this monster is associated with a giant whirlpool, which they don't show in the film if somebody. And the other thing I want to say to our listeners, which I probably should have said at the top of the podcast, and I've said elsewhere when we do some film reviews, is when anyone is adapting any piece of literature into a film, they're really separate works. They're not really supposed to just be a literal interpretation of a piece of literature. Because a lot of times people will say, well, that wasn't like the book, or I like the film better. And I mentioned in a recent podcast, it might've been on the Odyssey, the film review, that even, you know, our most favorite films that are adapted from other things, for example, like Arrival, it's not exactly like the short story. And I don't think it's meant to be. But anyway, so that, you know, that monster's usually associated with the whirlpool, but it's not shown that way in the film. But what exactly, you know, define a little bit about how are you in particular in your articles using this term monster?
Yes, I will admit up front, I was using the term rather loosely for just kind of any, I want to be careful with my wording here, any out of the ordinary but concrete being in the world. So especially if it is destructive, I mean. So essentially, we could give a catalog of what functions as a monster in the Odyssey. We have the Cyclops, or rather the whole tribe of Cyclopes. We have the Sirens. We have Scylla, Charybdis, and even actually some of the just human societies or peoples that Odysseus comes across. The Laestrygonians, who are cannibalistic. The Lotus Eaters, who again behave like kind of otherworldly beings off on their own plane of existence. There's also another hostile tribe called the Siconians, who are so barbaric that, again, they function like monsters. Essentially, monster then is anything that is out of the ordinary but in the natural world, as I've been using the term. The term monster actually comes from a Latin word, monstrum, which comes from another Latin word, moneo monere, meaning to warn, because originally the word monstrum meant an omen or sign from the gods showing that something was going to happen, or that you shouldn't do something, or that you should do something, blah, blah, blah. Essentially, the idea was that in order to stand out as a warning to mortals, these signs from the gods had to be something extraordinary, but also something, again, happening in the natural physical world.
So anything unexplained to them?
Pretty much, yes. So what's interesting is I had to use that term kind of loosely because it's often unclear exactly where the natural ends and the monstrous begins for Homer, to the point that maybe it's not even useful to talk about the natural world versus, yeah, the monstrous. So again, you mentioned Charybdis. Charybdis was a real whirlpool off the coast of Sicily. Because actually,
that's interesting. Because they're trying to, I mean, you know, if you look at the CGI, you know, in the film, it just seems like this really almost kind of like a black hole that they're coming close to.
Yes.
But they don't show Charybdis at all in the film.
Well, no, Charybdis is the whirlpool.
I don't know. They don't have like some big monster coming out of it or something like we would think of, like a Hollywood.
No, you kind of think that the way Homer describes it, as if it were some kind of creature sucking up and spitting out the water. But it's clear in the original Odyssey itself that Charybdis just is a whirlpool. And we actually, Scylla too, as I mentioned in passing in the article, though she's represented in, or I should say it is represented in the Odyssey as a six-headed monster, you know, what is it, a woman from the waist down and a snake-like thing from the waist up, times six. It's actually a rock on the coast of Sicily, and there's a surviving fragment of the histories of the Roman writer Sallust in which he talks a little bit about how he thinks that this real oddly shaped rock formation on Sicily got turned into the Homeric monster. Essentially, from a distance, because of the way it's shaped, it looks like something with six heads. And then, thanks to its odd shape, the way the waves crash on it, it sounds like very loud barking of dogs. And so, Sallust's idea, which was, as far as I can tell, a very commonplace one in ancient times, is that Homer's Scylla starts out with just a rock that looks odd and produces odd sounds, but then is reinterpreted as something with six heads that makes a roaring or barking sound.
That's really fascinating. I want to move on to Zeus. At one point, you write about a philosophical Zeus, which maybe some pre-Christian Greek philosophers thought of as an abstract, not creator God, not in the same way that the Christian God is described in the Bible. So can you explain that a little bit more? What did you mean by philosophical Zeus?
Yes. So unfortunately, I don't know quite as much about early Greek philosophy as I would like, but it is certainly the case that as essentially the history of pagan religion, pagan Greco-Roman religion advances, Zeus becomes more and more supreme to the point of kind of excluding other gods as having any real power. I mean, even in something that's as mythological as Virgil's Aeneid, we get a more definite sense that Zeus is, or Jupiter is his Latin name, talking about Virgil, I should use that. Jupiter is absolutely in control. What happens in the world is determined by what he wants. And he also becomes less and less anthropomorphic, more abstract. And that's especially the case for philosophers in various Greek traditions. So, for instance, one of the pre-Socratic philosophers, Xenophanes, was absolutely disgusted, as I mentioned in the article, by the way that Homer and other early poets talked about the gods. They were essentially just exactly like humans, only they couldn't really be hurt and they never died, and they were exceptionally immoral humans. So what Xenophanes responded to with that is the idea that God is absolutely one. There is a divinity that created all things, sustains all things, controls all things, pervades all things. And what's interesting is there's a lot of inconsistency in people who picked up on the same ideas as Xenophanes about whether this one divinity could be identified with any of the conventional gods of the polytheistic system. So, and actually, another interesting thing about a lot of Greek and Latin pagan philosophy is, and theology, is they're sometimes all right with just being indefinite. Like in Plato's dialogues and other sources, a lot of the time you see talk of Hothéos, the god, or we could even just drop the article and say God. Plato seems not really to care whether we give this god a particular name because it's just kind of a supreme or abstract divine authority. Now, what happens in things like the phenomena of Aratus, the poem that the Apostle Paul quoted at the Areopagus is, well, let's see, I think I have ready to hand something that has a larger section of the text that Paul quoted, but essentially it's emphasizing the idea that what The poet refers to as Zeus. No, I do not have the text in front of me. Pervades all things, controls all things, is the source of all things. So, I mean, essentially what happens is we get the idea of a unitary divine creator sustainer. And sometimes inconsistently, that is identified with, you know, one of the gods of the Greco-Roman pantheon. And if you're going to do that, just what makes sense is the one who in the old conception that Xenophanes complained about was seen as the supreme or king of the gods, called in Greek Zeus, in Latin Jupiter or Jove.
I want to remind our listeners what I said in the intro as to why we should even read Homer in the first place, but I will make sure that it is linked in our show notes, as I noted that you go back and read Dr. Lewis Marcos's article that we published in 2009 that talks about why Christians should read the pagan classics, including Homer's Odyssey. So you won't want to miss that while you're doing part of this, reading this article as well, as why this is important for the Christian and why we're even talking about that. So you talk about in your article the idea of an impersonal fate in Homer. So what does that mean? How does this fit in with Homer's idea about the gods?
A lot of this honestly comes down to a kind of muddle-headed thinking, it has always seemed to me. So the Greek word that we, or I should say the Homeric Greek word, because there are various words for this in Greek, that various stages in its history, but the basic Homeric word that we usually translate as fate is moira, and it literally means just a portion or something that is apportioned to a particular individual, whether that's a person or a god or an animal or even an inanimate object. So really the Homeric epics are just remarkably unclear about what the relationship between Moira and the gods is. On the one hand, sometimes Moira is associated with a particular trio of goddesses called Moirae, or in Latin, Parcae. That's what we're talking about in English when we talk about the fates. What are their names? Clotho, Atropos, and Lachesis. These, you know, the three goddesses who are shown spinning the thread, pulling out the thread, cutting the thread of a human life. So sometimes fate is itself, in other words, seen as a separate god. Other times it is just kind of whatever happens. And it's not any real definite individual at all. And sometimes in Homer, the gods have to submit to fate just as much as humans do. Like there is a there's a scene in the Iliad, I want to say it's book 22, where Achilles is chasing the Trojan prince Hector around the walls of Troy. Meanwhile, up on Mount Olympus, Zeus takes out a pair of scales to determine, you know, what's going to happen to Hector, whether he will live or die. And it's just an impersonal force that, you know, weighs down the scale. Zeus himself has no more control over it than Hector or Achilles do. And he just has to accept the result. Other times, though, especially in the Odyssey, we see characters talking about the gods collectively as in control of fate. We get, you know, the expression moira theon, fate of the gods, in the sense of fate ordained by the gods. In other instances, we have characters saying bluntly and directly, the gods appoint moira fate for mortals. In other cases, it's specific gods who are said to be controlling things, whether it's Zeus or Athena, as I believe at one point also mentioned as being directly in control of somebody's, specifically Odysseus's, complete moira fate. So it's really unclear, just because I think in the end, Homer didn't have any definite ideas. Sometimes he just feels what happens, happens, and the gods have no more control over it than we do. Other times it's the gods inconsistently and kind of capriciously control our fates. Other times there seems to be a divine plan that is brought about by Zeus, like the opening of the Iliad actually talks about how the course of the poem represents the will of Zeus being fulfilled. though at the same time, it's also unclear whether that means the entire course of the poem, the entire course of the war, or just one particular action. Because again, Homer's just unclear.
So I just want to ask you if you think that the Odyssey and other mythological literature offers insights into the world. In other words, you know, we talked about the beginning. Why should Christians care about this? So why does this matter for Christians to engage with this work of literature?
I can't say for certain that there is anything that Homer tells us that we couldn't have gotten without Homer. He's certainly not an authority such that we absolutely could not do without him. What's valuable about primitive mythological writing, or again, it kind of comes from before writing, but primitive mythologizing, like what we find in Homer, is it shows us essentially man and the state of nature and what the views of man in a state of nature are going to be. If nothing else, it shows us this is where we are without any kind of revelation. Or I should say, without any special revelation. Don't want to get into the distinction between general and special revelation, so I'll just kind of throw the term out there and then leave it. And, I mean, there is definitely, to my mind, great value in seeing simply what the earliest, essentially the earliest people in the earliest people speaking the language that the New Testament was written in thought like. Because, I mean, the New Testament itself is in many ways very directly speaking to a Greek culture that was in key ways shaped by Homer. There are no references to the Homeric epics in the New Testament, but again, we see the Apostle Paul on multiple occasions quoting major pagan Greek writers, Aratus, Epimenides of Crete. At one point in 1 Corinthians, we get a line that comes from either Menander or Euripides, depending on which ancient authority you think is more accurate, since whatever he was quoting doesn't survive. But all that to say, if nothing else, it provides a not necessarily unique window, but a window on the kind of mindset or worldview that the New Testament was speaking to. And that is in some ways almost a pure expression of fallen man in the state of nature.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. And now I want to end on some fun rapid fire questions for Matt, because he is a new guest to the podcast. So Matt, what is your favorite meal?
I've always liked Mexican food. So give me a plate of tacos, ground beef or chicken or something like that.
And are you an introvert or extrovert?
Absolutely introverted. Classic INTJ.
And are you an early bird or a night owl?
That kind of depends on what time of year it is. If I have to wake up early for school, as I usually do, I'll go to bed early and wake up early. Summer, I tend to lose track of time and stay up till midnight or one.
And finally, you live in North Carolina. What's one of the things you enjoy about living in North Carolina?
I like the town I live in particular, Matthews. It's very convenient for somebody who likes to get places on his bicycle. I do not need to drive to go to the grocery store. Most people do anyway, but I usually take my bike and a backpack. I can get by bike to both of the libraries that I regularly use. The topography is very flat compared with where I was living before this in Chapel Hill for grad school.
Well, thanks, Matt, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you, Melanie.
You've been listening to episode 512 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Matt Dean. He has written an online feature article in our Literary Apologetics column, and his article is called "The Gods and the Monsters of Homer's Odyssey, A Christian Framework." You can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Please make sure you're subscribing to all of the podcasts available from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Daily Bible Answer Man podcast from CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who hosts a Q&A format Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturdays. You also want to add in Hank Unplugged, which are essential conversations about critical issues with some of the most interesting people on the planet. And these are in-depth, free-flowing conversations. Also, the two podcasts from the Christian Research Journal, this one that you're listening to now, Postmodern Realities, which is author interviews and discussions, and also our audio article podcast, Christian Research Journal Reads. And please don't forget to try out our very newest podcast just debuting in 2026, which is called A Commitment to Reality from Dave Hanegraaff. And again, all of our podcasts are available on all the platforms. So wherever you get your subscription feed, please make sure you add in our podcast. And thank you so much for your partnership and for listening.